Welcome to Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. I'm Richard Dugan, your host. Thanks so much for joining us here on the program. We come your way Sundays at 7 a.m. and p.m., Monday mornings at 1 a.m. We are streamed live at richarddugan.com and newspress.com. We also archive these programs at richarddugan.com, the radio show's page. Lots of opportunity for you. We also link to the websites of our guests so you can seek out and find the information that you want directly from the source in that regard. So we encourage you to take advantage of all of that. And again, thank you so much for joining us. It's incredible. These summer months are flying right on by. We've blown through June. We're blowing through July, and I'm hoping that we blow through August, September, and October, get back to the cool weather again, swinging back towards the shortest, the day with the shortest amount of sunlight. I hear that phrase quite often when I hear about the solstices, or is it solstice? Anyway, where they say it's the longest day of the year for summer solstice, it's the shortest day of the year for winter solstice, and both of those statements are inaccurate because there is no such thing as a longer or shorter day unless you're using the term to describe the amount of daylight in that given day. That is the only way that you can differentiate the 2 days in that regard. But I prefer the shorter daylight days because I like the cool weather. After growing up in Phoenix, Arizona, I've had enough of the hot weather. Of course, some people are then saying, well, you know, you notice that the statistics are showing that the planet is warming and you don't have too many other places to go other than north. And after a while, there won't be any place to go that's not warm. I'm hoping that changes. and my energies are working in that direction. So anyway, I'm certainly glad to be here. Glad you're with us. And I'm also glad that our guest is with us. She is the author of her latest work, When Life Cried Out, a One Woman's Spiritual Quest to Be Fully Alive. She's also considered a mystic. We're going to get a definition of that as well. She is a very intriguing woman. We're going to find out more about her. Patty Favette, I want to thank you so much for joining us on the program.
Thank you. I'm so thrilled to be here.
This is quite extraordinary in terms of, I mean, you know, it's from some perspectives, you know, it's sort of the height of egotism to take on labels. I mean, I'm not one for doing that myself. Any labels that anybody refers to me by, they gave it to me. I didn't seek it out. Just simply because I find it very interesting. The universe tends to, when I get a little too full of myself, and it's been a long time since that's happened, the universe has ways of humbling me. And so I've learned from those lessons from the years gone by and just saying, you know, I'm here. What are we doing? And which direction do you want me to go? And, just foregoing all of the surnames or the labels and what have you. I'm appreciative for those people who seem to see that in me, and it's not that I'm denying that. But by the same token, especially with this term being referred to as a mystic, that intrigues me not so much because in terms of, you know, referencing you, Patty, but just in terms of even reading about the mystical life. That, now that intrigues me. Seeking out and trying to find the mystical aspects, even of one's own life, that are what? Extraordinary, supernatural, paranormal. I'm not even sure where I would put the mystical life, if you will. I guess I would have to use the term mysticism as well. Can we talk a little bit about that as we get started here?
Yes, I can. I would be glad to. I don't use the word mystical life to define myself, but more in the way of keeping me attuned to the subtleties that are beyond the obvious. There's so much richness is out here in the world. You know, it's hard to even think about that these days, about the good and the richness, because there's so much horror going on in the news media. They're telling us about this happened in France and that happened somewhere else, and it's just really horrible. But and I put the word modern mystic in front of it to differentiate myself from those who truly were mystical and very in contact with God that have been dubbed saints over the years by I think the Catholic Church has done that, or that we think of as that way, a pious people who lived very rich, fulfilling lives, but sequestered within, I don't want to call them compounds, but sequestered within in holy institutions.
Sort of like the monastic order.
Yeah, of one form or another. So I attach the word modern mystic, and it keeps me righteous on a daily basis. So I will know that there's beauty and love in the butterfly. There's beauty and love in the flower. There's beauty and love in the trees. There's beauty and love in the faces of your best friend, and beauty and love in the face of somebody that you would think of as your enemy. And when I say the mystical life, this is what I'm talking about. It's that oneness of connection. So when I call myself a modern mystic, it's more to keep me in that mindset than it is to self-define.
Yeah, I've read a number of books over the years, and of course my own personal metaphysical primer is Autobiography of a Yogi, where I read about some of the what would be classified as mystical experiences that are described in that book, and thinking, wow, that would be neat to have. You know, there's that sort of childlike exuberance of wanting to discover that, wanting to experience that kind of thing. But as I continue to read, I realize that didn't just happen overnight. There was a lot of work, maybe even years, if not decades, before this person achieved that level of awareness and understanding of the universe, of spirit, of existence, of consciousness, and so forth.
What happened with me is that years ago, I was so disconnected from myself that I was not functioning. In fact, I had contemplated dying at my own hand, and I even had the gun at my hand one night. And I described this in the book, When Life Cried Out. But and there in the sunlight, I looked down the barrel of, I mean, in the moonlight, I looked down the barrel of the gun, and I realized I could see nothing. It was just a dark passageway. And I thought, where is my light? Where is my light? And it was more of a prayer. It was more than a question. It was more of a demand of myself, of spirit, God, the universe, whatever you want to call it, the higher power with capital letters. It was more of a demand. It was a pleading demand. Where is my light? Do I really want to do this? And it wasn't long after that I got a stage one, you never find them at stage one, or that's rare anyway, melanoma directly on my back, about the level of my heart. And I realized, I've got a way out. All I have to do is nothing. Just let the thing grow. I'm gone. And I realized at that point that this little stage one melanoma was the best thing that had happened to me, because I realized that it wasn't death I wanted. It was life. I wanted to live and breathe and love what I was seeing and love what I was doing. I wanted to look in the mirror and actually see who I really was. I wanted to feel righteous about myself with all my faults. And I wanted to know something that was loving about myself. And I was just lost at that point. But that what beautiful little event in my life taught me that it wasn't the darkness that I wanted. It was light, and I did not have it. And so one night, not long after that, it was in a thunderstorm. I was doing some writing, and it had started as automatic writing about this time. And for those who wonder what that is, it was an experience I had at a intuition seminar. A friend of mine bribed me with some free energetic treatments if I would come and just be a person in a chair at a seminar. She knew my intuition was blocked from child from childhood. It was not validated. And so I went, just because, hey, it's something free, I'd get out of it. So I went, but I was able to follow along with all the exercises. And the last day, she said, go into a dark room or a place, a quiet place, in Maria's house. The teacher, Tina, told us to do that. And right at the top of your paper, I had a yellow legal tablet, right at the top of your paper, a question that has bothered you all your life. Well, I didn't want to go because I didn't expect anything. But I thought, well, everybody else is going. I don't want to be odd man out. So just for peer pressure, not more than anything else, mm-hmm. I went in the back corner of her bedroom and sat on the floor in Sufi mystic fashion, like I knew what I was doing, and I sort of didn't know what I was doing, but obviously I didn't need to know everything I was doing. And I wrote at the top of my paper the question that has bothered me all my life, and that question was, why do I never feel good enough? And the next thing I knew, I went into the breathing exercises she told us and got into altered state as best I could, perfectly imperfect. And my right hand, was still holding the pen, began to write at the top of the page. It was right at the bottom of the page. It wrote in the middle of the page, and it kept writing like this. And I got the answer to my question that way. I didn't know what I was writing or what was being written through me, but I was able to witness myself doing it in this altered state. I did not go back to the room because I was in tears. Something out there worked through me to answer my question, what is this something? You see, Richard, when I was growing up, I was shown at age 6 in the very fundamentally religious church that we went to, I was shown a picture of people burning in hell and screaming and said, this is what happens to bad little boys and girls if they don't do what God wants them to do. So that's where I was coming from. And it was more of a punishment type thing, do right or be punished, what I got out of religion. But here I was at age 50, 52, right in there somewhere, and this loving, loving, loving event happened and answered my question. Wow. So it wasn't long after that the thunderstorm was raging outside the door. The flowers were beaten to a pulp in the garden because of the heavy raindrops, and that's about how I felt. At that time, I was very agoraphobic. I was in a marriage that was not doing me any good, and I was very agoraphobic. I was having panic attacks a lot. And I stayed in the house a lot. I went to the grocery store to get food and come home and feed the family. But so on my knees in that thunderstorm, I did what opened a gateway to a mystical experience of my own life. Mm-hmm. I prayed with all the energy I had, with every cell in my body felt this prayer. Whatever is standing in the way of my spiritual path, may it fall from me. Mm. Ooh, for those who are listening, if you ever pray something that intense, and with light, love, and ease, because it wasn't. So, and at that moment, looking back on that moment, I realized that I was willing. I was very open to whatever would happen. I completely surrendered my wants and desires to a greater, higher wants and desires, and I trusted it would happen. Hmm. W-O-S-T, willingness, openness, surrender, and trust. And so there I was. And that's when my life really began to turn around. That's when I realized my life had value. Not immediately. It was just like you said a moment ago to the listeners. It happened gradually. It wasn't instantaneously, although the automatic writing was instantaneously. But the rest of my experiences that are detailed in When Life Cried Out, they happened over a 7-year period, so it wasn't just an immediate thing. But with every experience, I felt like I had grown into something beyond what I was previously. I feel like to answer your question, and I'm going about it a long way.
That's okay.
But I feel like a mystic is a person who has, in their own way, experienced a direct connection somehow with the presence of God that exceeds ordinary description and the person is therefore deeply transformed by this experience. So although my experiences may have been small to other people's way of thinking of what mysticism was or mystic experience was, to me they were huge. Each little moment, each little event was life-changing, and to me it was huge.
Patty Pavette is my guest, and she's the author of When Life Cried Out, One Woman's Spiritual Quest to Be Fully Alive. I have to say that you and I share, in an interesting way, similar educational backgrounds. Although when I describe this to you, you're going to say, not possible. You have your Master's of Science and Doctorate of Philosophy in Metaphysics, which I love, from the American Institute of Holistic Theology, with an emphasis on the integration of body, mind, and spirit. I worked for 15 years for a Christian radio station. It was the greatest education
for what?
A Christian radio station.
Oh.
It was the best education I was ever paid for.
Yeah.
And it was extraordinary because through that period of time, I went through because I was born and raised Catholic, I went through a very pro-Catholic phase.
Mm-hmm.
Then I went through a very pro-Protestant phase, and I was still asking questions to where I finally entered what I would call my metaphysical phase,
I've
been ever since. And
yeah.
I still remember someone I was chatting with about all of this, and they were telling me, I told them that I had begun my search at the age of 17, which is when I read Autobiography of a Yogi.
Oh, yeah.
And they said, well, you know, as far as your search is concerned, once you've found Jesus, your search is over. And the only thing I could think of was, no, once I find Jesus, it's just begun. from that perspective. And when I left that radio station after 15 years, I remember the general manager of the station at the time said to me that because of some of the things that I had shared with him in my experiences through the 15 years, I'd become a Baha'i. I had investigated different things, including the Muslim faith, in the context of an interview that I had done, a two-hour interview that he had listened to. And the first question out of his mouth was, "Are you Muslim?" And I thought, "No, I'm just curious. I'm not converting. I'm fine. I'm happy where I am right now."
Mm-hmm.
In any event, he said I was a casualty of Christian radio, which I thought was an unusual thing to say. But it was an extraordinary education that I had, and I have been dubbed here in Santa Barbara, at least by the people I work with, as Dr. D, more for my audio engineering than my theological or metaphysical perspectives, but nonetheless. And I am so intrigued by folks such as yourself who, I mean, you came from sort of a similar background as far as you've sort of described, sort of a fundamentalist and or evangelical Christian background.
Yes, I did.
And yet, here you are today with the kind of education that I described earlier and the type of experiences. See, I'm intrigued by people, especially people like an Edgar Cayce, who, in spite of all of his, shall we call them, Christian protestations against that which he was doing, he continued to do it. And I found that so extraordinary. There are many people who have these belief systems that they've taken on. And yet, there are other parts of their lives that they can't seem to turn their back on. It's like kind of like, you know, what your the title of your book, When Life Cried Out. These experiences cry out to them saying, there's more. You don't have to give up what you already believe. Embrace more, because there is more.
That's so well said. There is more. I heard somebody one time talking about believing in Jesus. Good. Wonderful. This is great. great,
mm-hmm.
but also believe with.
Mm.
It doesn't stop with just the in. It starts, you know, it. That's like you said, and I love the way you phrased it, that's just the beginning.
Yeah.
It's just the beginning. There's so much more. I think sometimes that people don't open up to something in addition to as well as more, you know, the more. Take it deep. Mm-hmm. Sometimes we don't take it deep because it scares us.
Yeah.
We challenge our own status quo.
Now, there's an interesting twist to all of this, too. You and I both are of sort of, I'll say, similar open mindset. You know, we're willing to take a look at and even experience certain things that maybe most other folks would not. And I had an interview with a Christian author. He was actually a musician, and this goes back to the 1980s.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember him sharing a very interesting experience with me in the interview that I have never forgotten, because it said to me, my gosh, that even these Christians who have this, who were part of, and he says he was part of the Jesus movement in California, and he moved to New England, and he and his wife were living there, and he was sitting in his writer's room looking out the window at the leaves turning, and what struck him, the thought that struck him was, is what I believe what I've been told to believe, or is what I believe what I believe? And this transcends not just the main religions, if you will, but even metaphysics, even spirituality, because we are told so much. You know, we hear about the chakras, and we hear about the angels, and we hear about the Pleiades, and we hear about the sacred sites, and on. I mean, the list is just enormous. But we just take it at face value because, oh, we're metaphysical and spiritual and, you know, we must embrace these things. But is this what you've chosen? Does it ring? As I say at the beginning of this program, usually we put out a smorgasbord and you take what you want and leave the rest. Take what resonates with you. So maybe that's the question. When did this type of information, this type of insight through your intuition, because it seems to me that's really what kicked this off, when did it become yours and not theirs?
I can't say there was one moment. I can say it was a gradual set of steps that still is ongoing. And I'm convinced that when you open up to the really truth, show me the truth, show me my truth here on this earth, show me my sacred story. What is my sacred story? Help me live my sacred story. Help me understand it. Help me know what love is with a capital L from the inside of my heart out, not from the outside in. And that's the difference. You look for these things from the inside out. And I'm convinced that finding our own sacred story, that moving around in the world is a set of steps. There is no there that you arrive at. You keep sinking. You always keep sinking. You think you understand something deeply, and then you turn around and there's another story, another meaning, another truth, another piece of wisdom right behind that. There's no ending to this as far as I'm concerned. So to answer your question, I would have to say it started gradually. It started with my question and answer sessions. That was like spiritual psychology 101, because that's what I needed at the time. And I'm convinced when we are willing and open and surrender and trust to the greater story of our own life, that spirit, in whatever form you want to believe it, whether you call it God or another name for God or higher self or whatever, presence with a capital P, you know, whatever you call it, and the whole universe, the cosmos, actually, is standing behind you, ready to support you in your journey. And they will come to you, it will come to you, support you initially in the way that you can understand it. And that's what people miss. They think, I'm supposed to understand this the way Mr. X or Mrs. Y or Organization Z, does it. You know, I need to be one of the group. Maybe we all go through a stage of like that, but we have to trust ourselves to know that the story comes to us, our sacred story comes to us in the way we understand it. My way of understanding it started with writing, but it didn't end there. I had an experience at the church at Skreen, S-K-R-E-E-N. If anybody out there wants to look it on the internet, there's some pictures. It's a hillside in Ireland with an old ruins of a church. And directly across the valley on another hill is the Hill of Terror. I had thought I was supposed to go to the Hill of Terror at that time. And this was early on in my journey. And why, I don't know. I just felt like I needed to go. So I snagged a traveling companion and beep-bop, off we go to the Hill of Terror because I thought I was supposed to be there. And my traveling companion was looking around at some of the old, what are they, Neolithic sites? Some of the older monuments that are there that are there, and he was looking at them. He said, I think these look like male and female. And I just looked at him, and I looked across the valley, across the expressways, and up the hill where the Church of Skreen is, and I said, that's where I'm supposed to be. It was like I had been punched in the gut with a feeling. So we bebopped. It was almost not quite sunset, but we had to get there in daylight. So we figured out how to wind the Irish countryside, and we got up. And that was the most wonderful experience for me at that time, because I sat there with my back supported against those strong stone walls and watched the sunset. And I had what I would call my first mystical experience. It wasn't something I knew, although it translated into a knowing. It was something I felt. I felt at one with the sunset. I felt at home for the first time in my life. I felt like I knew and I didn't know, like the great unknowing or the great unknown was part of me. It's extremely difficult to put a mystical experience into words because it is beyond words. Words have specific and limiting meaning, while a mystical experience is beyond limited meaning. But I felt one with everything, with the sunset, with the grass, with the wall behind me, with the ancient people who used to worship and do their thing in that old ruins of a church. And I felt like for the first time in my life, I felt like there was something big and huge that I was a part of. And that's as far as it went. It was like they say in the Bible, the be still and know. That's what it was. It was a stillness, but it was a fulfilling stillness. It was a connected stillness. It was a stillness that was beyond anything I had experienced before up until that time. But that grew in different ways. But it was an initial feeling. Be still and know, and that's where I was. But my gut had told me while I was standing on the Hill of Terror that I had to be across on that other thing. And that's how it came to me. It came through a knowing, just oh my goodness, there it is. So often, you know, the indigenous tribes used to be so in contact with nature and the world around them. And I think over the years, we have educated ourselves beyond that innate knowing. And there's nothing wrong with the analytical process. It's a great process. But I feel like we have grown a society, we as a society have grown to a form of analytical processing. And we have lost the deep, earthy connection that is really very much part of ourselves. We have lost our intuition, and it's just as much a part of what we need to be as the analytical is. Because it's nice to figure out something. It's nice to sit down with the numbers or whatever and see relationships and the business model, you know, and it's fantastic. I mean, these things are wonderful. but you also have to know how spirit whispers to you. Intuition, to me, is the voice of the soul. So how is spirit whispering to you? Do you have thought? You know, just a thought appear? Do you, a knowledge will appear without knowing it? Do you feel, do you hear a thought? Do you feel something, you know, just a gut feeling for no reason at all? Do you have visions, you know, dreams or visions or waking visions? You know, it comes to us in different ways, and this is what is so important to me, for to know our own sacred story. Don't give up the analytical, for heaven's sakes. This is one of the intelligence. Keep your intelligence. My goodness, I wish more people did. But don't give up the innate spiritual connection that you have.
Yeah.
And it doesn't come in a box.
No.
It's unique for each of us.
I find it fascinating because each of us expresses it in a different way. And there are 7 billion people plus on the planet, which means that it's expressed in at least 7 billion different ways, which is extraordinary. No two people have the same experiences. And part of my thinking is that in spite of the fact that we are constantly, folks like you and I, sharing our philosophy, our beliefs, our experiences with others, not only in an effort to understand them ourselves, but also to share them with others, to give them an idea of where we're coming from, because maybe it will help them along their path a little ways. It's like that analogy I heard some time ago, that we're all climbing up these ladders, and there's someone above you and there's someone below you. And the person above you is reaching down to help you up. And in turn, you reach down and help the person below you up.
Beautiful vision.
And yet, each of us has these different expressions. And there's a part of me that thinks, well, you know, it's great that we're sharing all this stuff, but the reason why it isn't working for you is because it's not your vision. It's not your experience. And in some cases, that's true. We try to recreate or emulate the experiences of others, thinking that that's the way to go. It reminds me of a lot of what I was being taught as I was growing up, as well as at the Christian station. And it didn't make a lot of sense to me when I started evaluating human existence, thinking when you come into this world, there are hundreds of thousands of different ways of nourishing the body through the various foods that we might ingest, and different flavors and textures and colors and on and on. And the same thing with drink. And then the same thing with education. They always tell you to expand your horizons and, you know, just, you know, learn all you can, kind of thing, right?
Yes.
And then on the other areas as well. But then when it came to spirituality, there was only one way. That didn't make any sense. It was so illogical to me that in every other aspect of human existence, there were literally millions of choices that we could make. But there was only one when it came to our spirituality. And I couldn't accept that.
It's fascinating, isn't it?
Yeah, it didn't resonate with me.
No, it doesn't resonate.
Yeah. And
yeah,
so,
it doesn't resonate.
Yeah, and so I began to investigate. That's why I found this group of Baha'is in Phoenix that I began to attend their firesides. I asked them questions, you know, and they were always steering me towards the writings. And I says, yeah, but I like reading this and this. Well, that's fine. You can go ahead and read those. But from our perspective, it's only going to lead you right back here. Well, oh, certainly that was their perspective, and they were certainly welcome to it. And for a year and a half, I was a member. The other aspect of it I mentioned, and you talk about this as well, is choice. That we have choices. We say on this program that we are here to bring you choices and knowledge of those choices to help make your dreams come true. And
Yes. If
you don't know what choices are available, how can you choose them? And I find it so sad, so disheartening sometimes when I hear about our educational system and how deplorable it is in this country as compared to other countries, how we're not teaching our children, we're not giving them the base they need, we're not teaching them how to think, we're just teaching them what to think, and rote memorization isn't making choices, isn't really learning, from my perspective. I could be wrong. But again, if you wanted to be a nuclear physicist, but you didn't know that nuclear physics even existed, how could you choose it? And maybe you have the aptitude. Maybe you're the one that's going to crack the code that's going to allow us to develop a sustainable, safe form of energy for the planet.
And if you feel like that's your possibility, for heaven's sakes, don't let the world tell you it's not.
Yeah, exactly.
There are going to be 1,000 people with 10,000 different opinions. And go inside yourself. You know, find your spirit. Find the precious part of you that is connected to the greater story. Find your little drop in a sea of God. And don't let the world tell you that you can't do it.
Yeah.
Or that it's not possible.
Yeah. Patty Favette is my...
Or any other value-based judgment.
Exactly. Patty Favette is my guest. We're going to continue our conversation here on Tell Me Your Story. Stay tuned. Welcome back to Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. I'm Richard Dugan, your host, and I'm joined by Patty Favette, PhD. She is the author of a book entitled When Life Cried Out. Patty, I did some research, I did find that church, that parish, Skreen, S-K-R-E-E-N, in the northwestern part of Ireland. There are many sacred sites there in Ireland, just to elucidate, especially one my wife and I fell in love with, and it was called Newgrange on the eastern.
I've been to Newgrange.
Oh, it's I being auditory and being a sound engineer for so many years. When we entered the chamber, and I don't have you. Did you were you able to go into the chamber?
Yes.
When I walked down into the when we reached the bottom of the chamber. And of course, they don't allow you to record your experience in any way, shape, or form, audio, video, cameras. The only thing I could think of as I'm standing there listening to the person talk and the other people chatting a little bit here and there, it was the most perfectly acoustic interior I had ever been in.
It was.
Oh.
I'm not into sound. In fact, I have a hearing loss, and wear hearing aids, and so that's not my forte, not my gift like it is yours. But I intuitively felt it. I said, there's something in here that there's a perfection that is beyond anything I understand.
Yeah. And then on top of that, if you have the pleasure of being selected in the lottery to be standing at the bottom of the monument, if you will, or a sacred mound inside, on December 21st or 22nd, depending upon when the winter solstice is, you will see the sunlight come pouring in to that chamber and illuminating it. I haven't yet. I look forward to one day doing that. Then there's another site down in the southwestern corner of Ireland. It's a sacred circle, sacred stone circle called Drumbeg. My wife and I went down there. We'd located it on the map, and we were out there taking pictures, and suddenly the winds had already been blowing, and then the rain started coming down. And this is the coldest rain I can ever remember. Now, it wasn't that cold. But it wasn't like it was going to snow, but because of the winds, and yet it was so exhilarating. I don't know if it was because of where we were, specifically the stone circle, that sacred site, or it was because we were so elated by the fact that we were in Ireland. So there are many of these sites, and a lot of them, this is what I find so interesting. They supposedly are pre historic. They predate recorded history, I guess, is how that's defined. So where did they come from? How did the people, if they were humans, how did they know how to erect these in the positioning and the form and the style that they did? I have a feeling if it was humans, it goes back to what you've been talking about throughout this entire program, and that is intuition.
I think it does, too. I think it does, too. I think the early people on this earth, this is just my opinion based on my experiences, I really think the earliest people on this earth had an innate connection that we have educated ourselves out of.
It's as if our educational system has untaught us, so to speak, or maybe layered over with stuff that we really don't need. And so now you are sharing with us ways in which we can sort of remove those layers. And
I really think there is. I really, really think there is. I never decided to go to a specific sacred site or have a specific experience. And I've been to Malta. I've had an Ireland and Scotland and all kinds of places like that. I have been to Auschwitz. I have, and that's not a sacred site, but I had a sacred experience there. But I have been to many, many places. I've been to the South Pacific. And I never decided that I wanted to go. It always came to me that I needed to go. See, that's a big difference. There's a big difference. I didn't go after the experience. The experience came to me because I was open enough to know. I wanted to understand feminine rage. Tell me about feminine rage. The next thing you know, I am at Malta flat on my back with a back that has completely gone out, and I'm having to use the pay-by-the-minute telephone to call a healer friend of mine in Atlanta and say, what is going on? She said, you are channeling feminine rage on the cosmic level. Oh, my word! You know, and she goes on like that, and I said, well, it had to be more than just being mad at the females, you know, that raised me or something, you know. Mm-hmm. We're taking each other out. I'm just enraged, you know. And the rage in me attracted that, and so I was able to heal the anger that I had from some experience that I had had, in my life. But so that, you know, I got that there, but I was not attracted. Hey, I did not say, hey, I think I'll go to Malta and heal feminine rage. I didn't know the feminine rage. I just felt like I needed to go to Malta, you know, and, mm-hmm. and just out of the blue, just felt like I needed to go to Malta during it. And it was the same way with the temples of the Nile. I had waking visions and this type of thing. And to go back what you were talking about, I was older. I had studied intuition. But had I been a child and said, there's a lady with a funny hat that keeps popping into my mind, and I don't know that she has any hair, but the hat is bigger in front than it is in back. I'm talking about Nefertiti.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, if I were a child telling the adults, what would the adults say? Oh, it's just your imagination. It's just your imagination. Or if the child comes to them and says, I'm seeing angels. It takes a special parent to say, yes, you may. Tell me about that. Instead of saying, I don't think so. And, you know, invalidating a child's experience. I think we are born with an innateness that, an innate connection that is not validated either through the school system, through our parents, because they don't know. They don't know.
You know,
they haven't gotten there themselves. They don't know. I know when I was a child, I had an oak tree, and that oak tree was just as alive and active and had as much spirit to me as my mother or my father.
Mm.
It was, but they did not understand that. Oak tree does not want this, you know.
Yeah. Well, and I would say that from my experiences as well, that is certainly true. And that was something that was always intriguing to me. And when I began doing this program nearly 8 years ago, I've been interviewing for over 35, but the focus on this program has been very interesting. I've had a few fundamentalist Christians on the program who have had extraordinary experiences. And the one thing that always sort of frustrated me about the hierarchy of Christendom in general was that if the experience was not found in the book, you had to discount it. You could not express anything in regard to that experience. And it's like, wait a minute. How can you do that to an individual?
Yeah, I don't know how you could possibly do that to individuals. Don't you think that's fear-based?
Oh, very much so. Very much so.
I think it's fear-based.
It may be fear in terms of the fact that they didn't, the hierarchy, the individuals involved, haven't had that experience, so they have no points of reference. Or because they're afraid that if this experience is had by more people, they won't, the hierarchy, have the control that they want over the people.
And I would like to say it with organizations, and I'm not just talking about religious organizations. Mm-hmm. I'm talking about, I'm talking about almost all organizations. Mm-hmm. It's a rare organization that doesn't follow this pattern. The organization starts with a specific purpose. Maybe it's to feed the hungry. Maybe it's to do something with the trees on the planet. I don't know. Whatever the purpose, the organization starts with that purpose. But after a while, the purpose of the organization still is written on the stationery somewhere, but the purpose, it changes, it morphs. It changes into maintaining the organization and maintaining the status quo of the organization, and it loses its initial purpose. Have you noticed that? I have noticed it time and time again.
Very much so, and it's really, I was a part of one or two organizations. One of them was a nonprofit. It was actually a radio station. Mm-hmm. And as it grew and as it became more prominent, it began to, of course, make changes, which is always a good thing. But I always felt as though there were certain aspects of it that were being lost. When we first started, and in the first, I'd say, 5 or 7 years, it was very much like a family. And and we worked together and we had a grand time. And no matter what happened, we were still there with the main focus of providing the service that we were providing.
Yeah.
But again, as it grew and expanded, rules were set down, policies and procedures, which, again, I understand that there are those who feel that those need to be in place. But it began to detract from that free-flowing energy that we had in the beginning. And so by the time I left, it wasn't even close to what it was when I first started.
And it becomes maintaining the status quo of the organization.
Yeah. But then think about it from the terms of a human being born.
Mm,
and you have the baby, and the baby grows, and an infant into a toddler, into a child, into a preteen, teenager, and on and on and on. And it's influenced by all of its environment, be it educational, religious, parenting, et cetera, and turns out to be the type of adult that all of that training, if you will, has sort of created. Yet that individual still has the freedom to choose to go in whatever direction that individual wishes to. But organizations aren't quite the same way. Institutions, in that regard, I even use the word institutions, they don't have quite the same freedom because there are some who want to maintain a certain level of control.
That's right.
I have, and maybe that's one of the reasons why I've never really joined a lot of groups, is just because I know what's going to happen here. And we happen to be a part of an organization that does some great work with animals. But I've noticed that some new protocols have come into play. And it's like, and how does this change the work that we're doing on our end if we don't do what you're asking us to do? We're still at this end providing the love and the care and the nurturing that we always would. And yet it's almost as if, well, but if you don't, then you can't be a part of the group.
That's exactly right. It becomes exclusionary.
Yes.
Instead of inclusionary, it moves from to exclusionary.
Yeah. We need to open up our we need to open up our institutions. What was it? I heard a statistic regarding education, especially higher education, that the makeup, both racially and economically, of institutions of higher learning is becoming it's getting smaller and smaller. Not the populations of the institutions, but the diversity, if you will, because individuals who would love to go after higher education don't have the income. They don't have the wherewithal. And what's even worse is if they find it through student loans, immediately they're on the road to debt. And there's something wrong with that equation that says if you want an education, you must go into debt. And you must become an indentured servant to the system for 10, 20, 30 years after your education, because that's what the institutions want. Why can't you and I just walk into an institution of higher learning with the desire? And there are ways to prove whether an individual really has the desire. That should be the prerequisite. Is that desire to learn, to want to grow?
It should be.
Yeah.
I tried to take some courses one time. There was one, and it was an organization on the West Coast, and I thought, well, I'd like to take some courses, and I just wanted to take, and this wasn't a school, but I just wanted to take one particular set of learning that meant something to my life at that time. And I thought, you know, this may help me get further ahead. And I wanted to do that. And I contacted this institution, and they said, oh, well, you cannot just jump in and take what you want and do what you want. You have to start at the beginning so that we train you the way you need to be. And I couldn't hang up the phone quick enough.
Yeah.
And you know, I just had, who knows how I need to be? I've been all over the world, and I still don't know how I need to be, except for the fact that I just need to be me.
And unfortunately, that's happening too, even within the metaphysical institutions.
It is.
And I really do have to wonder a little bit about all of that, because again, it's not really serving anybody. It's not really serving in the way that it ought to keep people open and interested, and keeping their passions alive. And it's hard enough. It's hard enough to get people to try to find their purpose in life.
Oh, it is. Do you know if we are really, really, really aware? I think we can be our own best teacher.
I think you're right.
I really think we can be our own best teacher. These days, all I need to say is, I need to learn about this, that, or the other, you know, whatever the topic would be. I need to broaden my awareness in this area. And the next thing I know, a book will just sort of fall into my lap, or I'll notice a TV program maybe, or I'll hear a radio broadcast, you know, over the Internet. I'll read an article, or maybe somebody will mention it. But you know, it'll just synchronistically, it will just happen. And when you're in tune and start looking for this type of thing, it is there. doing something to define yourself in order to learn, I just don't know that that's the most optimal way to do it. I think learning is an inside-out job,
yeah,
instead of an outside-in. You learn to increase your understanding. You don't learn to define yourself.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think you're very right about that. It's a process that we do. It really truly is an individual process, whether you're in an institution of higher learning or not. I mean, I remember when, I've never been to university, but I've been to junior college. Mm-hmm. And I remember enrolling in an English course thinking, it wouldn't be hurt to get a little more English. I didn't do too terribly bad in grade school and high school, but eh. And of course, then I found out, you'll have to write 6 essays during the term, thinking, I've never written an essay in my life. I don't know what one is, the structure. Well, of course, that's what the whole educational process was for, to learn how to write one. I had the most fun writing those 6 essays I have ever had in my life at that time.
Oh, have fun.
It was great because I just did. It was a wonderful thing. I think that in terms of our own growth on all of the levels, both physically, mentally, emotionally, and spiritually, it is a solo ride, but that doesn't mean that we can't solicit support, find some mentoring, if you will, let alone tutoring, along the way.
We don't have to do it all by ourselves. When I said learning is an inside job,
right, right,
that doesn't mean we're totally responsible and nobody else can, we shouldn't listen to anybody else.
Right, right.
Because teachers do come in, people who have had life experiences and have learned this can shortcut our process by listening to their life experience and what they have learned and gathering wisdom from what they have learned, but then yet applying it to our own life. Make it yours.
Yeah.
Make it ours. Make
exactly,
it mine.
Exactly. And that's one of the things, too, that some of our guests have talked about. I love what Greg Braden shared in our interview when we talked about the spontaneous healing of belief. He says that one of these days we're going to get to a point where our beliefs are going to transform into our knowing. It's not something we're going to believe anymore because we know it. We know
that
we know.
That's terrific.
Yeah. And I think that we're headed in that direction. The thing that I find fascinating, especially when it comes to alternative forms of health, is Chinese medicine. Been around for 5,000 years. Where was the FDA? they didn't need it because they knew that it worked.
That's right.
And they still
that's
know
right.
that it works.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that's one of the sad facts about not allowing us to read from some of the other sacred writings that have been left out of, for example, the Bible. I mean, there are only 66 books, maybe 69, depending upon, if you mm-hmm. accept the apocryphal scriptures, if you will, from the Old Testament in the Catholic Bible. But there are still, who knows, hundreds, if not thousands, of other books and other writings that we're not allowed to read because of the powers that be and what they are trying to accomplish. My first question sometimes when I start getting into these thought processes is, what is the end game? What is it that you're trying to achieve? Because I don't get it. I'm not one who wants to control hundreds of thousands of millions of people and make them do what I want, Simon Says kind of stuff. I've got enough trouble with my own life and getting me to do...
Oh, use the word challenges. It sounds better.
Okay. Challenges, exactly.
I got rid of the word trouble a long time ago.
Yeah.
It may be trouble. I'm going to say challenges.
Challenges is good. I like that very much so. And it's kind of strange. And I sometimes when I'm watching certain television programs, and I've seen enough of these programs, they're all basically the same. And I just look at it going, this is stupid. You know, what the heck is the end game in this thing? And a lot of these shows don't want to end. They just don't want to end.
Some of the television programs are so alike. It's just different characters doing the same thing.
Same things.
Violence of one kind or another. Yeah. Terroristic people throwing over things. And I'm talking about television. They're not real life. You know, it's like they have one script and 25 different shows put their own form to it.
Mm-hmm.
I've gotten to the point where I can't even follow those. It's mindlessness to me.
Yeah. Yeah,
and I don't mean mindless in the good sense. It's
exactly.
It's just dreading drudgery, just blah blah blah.
Mm-hmm.
And I just can't get there with a lot of these not all of them, but a lot of these programs on TV. I just can't get there.
Well, I have to say that as far as technology is concerned, in terms of entertainment, it's on the one hand, it's been an incredible boon because. Having given up my cable and my satellite for on-demand programming, I've seen movies I never would have seen or television programs I didn't even know existed. Some of them were pretty good. And some of these TV shows that I've seen were only 4 or 5 or 6 episodes long. They brought it to a conclusion, and it was over. And I'm going... Oh, I feel pretty good because it's kind of like reading a book, you know. I mean, I don't know that I want to jump into War and Peace, but something a little shorter. But it has a beginning, a middle, and an end, whereas a lot of television shows, they just want to stay on the air indefinitely, and you just can't do that. So why not write something that has a beginning, a middle, and an end, but don't keep rehashing the same things over and over again because that's... what I see in a lot of these dramas is, I find it difficult to sit and watch them, period, because it's like, well, wait a minute, didn't they just do this 3 weeks ago? Isn't this just a repeat of the same silly scenario? Where's the ending in this thing? And I realize that our lives don't have an end in terms of the essence of who we really are, the energy that sustains us, if you will.
And, you know, we always have choices. There are always choices. If you don't think that's true, examine yourself. Why do you not think that? There's always choices. I learned about real choice in the Great Pyramid. I've got this in one of my chapters in When Life Cried Out. And I've got a funny part at the beginning of that chapter about dealing with a very, very aggressive man who wanted me to ride on the back of his camel, and I finally ended up paying, it's funny the way it's written, I ended up paying him to leave me alone for the rest of the day. And then he wanted to even negotiate that, you know, so that part's funny. But when I got to you have to buy an extra ticket to get to the Great Pyramid, and I thought I was having a panic attack when I got up there. My traveling companion went and got our extra tickets, and I thought I began to shake and tremble a little bit, and it was power, like an inside power. I didn't know what that was I was feeling. I'm an environmental empath. I feel earth energies. And so, you know, I'm feeling something, and I'm thinking I misread it. I'm thinking I'm having a panic attack. I don't know what this is because it's really powerful, and it's literally affecting my body. But anyway, and one of the guards there noticed that I was not doing well, and he said, "You sit." And so he perched me on the side of the Great Pyramid for about an hour and a half while my friend got the ticket. And it was the best thing that could happen because I realized what I was feeling was the energy either of the pyramid or what was causing the energy underneath the pyramid or the energy that the pyramid was generating. You know, I'm not sure. But the energy was the pyramid, you know, however that happened. That's what I was feeling. And I wasn't sure what it was. So finally we get up there. Well, I'm running out of air in that little narrow passageway going up. Everybody else seems to be breathing fine, but I've got no air, so I'm wheezing a little bit. But I finally get into the king's chamber, you know, at the top of that pyramid. And, well, now what do I do? I had read, and it said the king's chamber was a place where, you know, it had a mausoleum type thing. And there was a great big stone vessel that was there that was big enough for, 10 bodies. But it did not, you said when you went to Ireland where the circles were, you said you had some ideas and you could feel, I had some ideas too. I thought, I'm not sure this pyramid, this is just my interpretation of what I was feeling. I'm not sure this pyramid, while it may have been used as a burial, chamber, I'm not sure that was its original intention. It felt more like a rite of spiritual passage of some sort to me. And you can say maybe that's what a burial chamber is, but I just didn't feel like it was just that. Anyway, so I want to know what I'm feeling. What is this really, really strong feeling? So I sit down, and my question and answer sessions are not working. I thought, all right, pen and paper, I'm ready to go, dictate, and nothing is happening. And so I start watching the people around me, and there's two people that are walking around doing what looks like laying on of hands of the pyramid, and they're walking around touching it. And then there's another group over to the side of this great chamber that are meditating, and I thought, well, do I need to touch it? Do I need to meditate? I don't know. So I wiggled a little bit. It's hard. It's stone, and there's no light, not really. They've got artificial lights, and then there's one little window hole at the top that I'm not sure had enough oxygen coming in it, but that was just my processing. And I thought, finally, I quieted my mind. My mind was going 90 miles a minute, and I finally quieted my mind. And I'm hearing a thought beyond me, and it's like it's always your choice. And it sounded like somebody near me had said the words, yet nobody was paying any attention to me, and there was nobody near me, but it was that strong. My intuition finally began to kick in. It said, personal power, you always have a choice. And what I had been searching for personal power for the longest time, and so I thought, well, there's something, but I needed more information, but it was not coming. It was just, that was all a personal power. It's always your choice. Do you know, I had never realized that in my life, personal power is a choice. I thought I was more in a reactive mode in my life, not personal power being a choice I could make, good or evil, righteousness, helping others, self-serving, narcissistic ways, greed, sharing, all these opposites began to fly at me. In fact, we each have these things going in our life, and we each can make choices. We each have this personal choice. And when I got to that point, when I realized that, it was not just in my head, it was something that was coming into my heart like a wisdom or a truth, a realization in that pyramid, that I realized that what I was feeling of that pyramid and the power is actually what I feel within myself and what you feel within yourself and what everybody has the chance to feel in their self. It's their that one little God spark, whatever you want to call it, your soul, you want to call it your spirit, your God spark, your connection, your white light, whatever you want to call it, it's that. And that's literally what I was feeling. The exterior of me, I realized, was actually interior. And once I realized that, the thought came to me, there's your choice as to how you wish to incorporate this. Good or evil, happy or sad, depressed or joyful, et cetera, psychological function or dysfunction. Your choice of response becomes your experience, not your reality. Let me say that again. Your choice of response, whatever happens in life to you, you have a choice as to how you can respond to this. And your response is what your true experience is. And your reality is of God. Your reality is of spirit. That is your reality.
I can attest to having personal experience of that in rather sort of mundane ways, in that I deal a great deal from time to time, as we all do, with what I like to call my vendors, my cell phone service, the electric company, the credit card companies, and so on and so on.
Yeah.
And I know good and well that if I go in with guns blazing, screaming, yelling with profanity about how I'm being mistreated as the customer, and on and on and on, I'm not likely to accomplish a whole lot. As a matter of fact, I'm more likely to have my number tagged that every time I call in, they won't take my call.
You're exactly right.
So every time I call in to try to resolve a matter, I go in doing my best to take the position of being firm but kind.
You can be firm and loving at the same time.
Yeah.
It's taken me a lifetime to understand that, but I finally got it.
Yeah. I mean, I still remember a portion of a conversation I had where I was asking a particular company to move my due date.
Mm-hmm.
And I know that that this particular vendor is computerized. And they were telling me, well, no, we can't change your due date. And I said, no. I know that you can, you won't, okay? I know that you can. It's computerized, it's code, and all you have to do or a supervisor has to do is go in and change the code, i.e. change the field information. So I was very clear on that. I did not get what I asked for, mind you, but that was okay.
Mm-hmm.
Because at least I walked away from that interaction with that person, and I even wished them a good day.
Yeah.
I walked away feeling clean. Now, I did have another experience with someone else who I got a little rude with.
Mm-hmm.
I wasn't profane or anything, but I wasn't stern and kind.
Mm-hmm.
Or as kind as I could have been. And so when the phone call was over, I thought about it for a couple of minutes, and I called right back, and I asked to speak to the same person. She'd give me her name. The gal says, well, the woman is on the phone with another person. Can I help you? And I said, okay, this is what da-da-da-da-da. And I said, and would you please pass on my sincerest apologies to her because I was not in the best frame of mind, and I spoke in such a way that really she didn't deserve to be spoken to in.
Mm-hmm.
So would you please? And she was, the woman I was speaking with was taken aback a little bit, but she said, I will pass that on. And I thanked her and have a nice day. So and again, every once in a while we slip, but for the most part, that's one of the things that I found is when you, and if you can take the same tack, let's say you're out there driving. These individuals who might be cutting you off, they didn't leave the driveway this morning saying, I'm going to get Richard today. Because they don't know Richard. Or I'm going to get Patty today. Because they don't know Patty. And we take it personally.
Yeah. I got all bent around the axle yesterday. There's a piece of rental property that we have, and this person was coming in for a week, and everything was supposed to be lined up. The manager was supposed to go and check, make sure everything was right. The cleaning crew was supposed to go in and clean up, and well, guess what? The manager hadn't checked. The cleaning crew hadn't come, and I had done what I was supposed to do, but nobody else did, you know. So, and where I almost got sidetracked with this was that the man who came in, well, of course he was upset. He'd paid his money. He needed a clean place, you know. And but he was so upset, his upsetness came through a voicemail. It came through email. And I felt rather attacked about this, you know, and there was no way I could call him back. He had a number that was not of United States origin, and my phone just wouldn't use it. You know, so long story short, I took a deep breath, walked around the house, and I thought, I have a choice. And instead of being angry, I'm going to try to understand him. And so I wrote an email last night. I am so sorry that you had this problem. I am horrified at what had happened. You know, I took that approach, and it worked. It turned the whole energy around with everything. And I took the same approach with the cleaning crew. I took the same approach with the manager. Let's find out what happened so it does not happen again. Well, I had used a wrong email address. Okay, that's my fault. I own up to it. The cleaning company just, it had just slipped through their process. Okay, how can we not have this happen again? You know, what is our check and double check with this? And so bottom line with this, everybody is satisfied. The renter, of course, you know, we're without that rent, but he has found a place and he is satisfied. He is not coming after me. And, you know, everything worked out well. But it was just like you said, had I not changed my mind, and had I gone in here with anger and vindictiveness, like a victim or a warrior who wanted to take somebody out, it would not have turned around as well. I was not bringing peaceful in. If I had done that, I would not have brought peaceful energy to the party.
Yeah.
But you have to be firm, you have to be grounded, and you have to be stand in your kind space, that kindness space, if you want to say it. I like to say the word loving, in your kindness space. But this, I'm sorry this happened. It should not have happened. I'm literally horrified it happened. But we're trying to figure it out. Let's make it better so
and,
it won't happen
yeah,
again.
And I have to say, too, that another aspect of it as well, and you alluded to that, is that when you find yourself, when you find the evidence that says that you made the mistake, i.e., in this case, in your example, the wrong email address, you just own up to it. You know, it's like, oh, I'm so sorry. I had the wrong email address. You know, and if it's still appropriate, I'll send it right off to the right one. And that's the reason why that part of the process didn't happen. Yeah. And I've had that happen a few instances where, it was on me and I owned up to it. And what's really been interesting about that, Patty, is I've had situations where I've owned up. I said, oh, you know what? I just realized, and I'm looking at the documentations and I'm telling the person on the other end of the line that da-da-da-da-da-da-da. And a lot of times it will still, if I can put it in this context, it will still have a wonderful outcome. It's still a win-win. You end up getting what you may have wanted in the first place if you hadn't made the mistake. And the company or whoever you're dealing with also feels like they've done a kindness as well. So it kind of perpetuates. Patty Favette is my guest, and we're talking about when life cried out. And Patty, we've really gone long here, and I'm grateful for the time that you have given us. I do know that you wanted to expound on what I just said, but I've got three questions that I want to ask you. So if you would like...
Okay, well, let's see if we can get that done before we end.
All right. If you would like to expound on what I just elucidated on in terms of you know, owning our own foibles along the way and being kind, I'd love to hear that, and then I'll ask you my three questions.
You know, when we own our own choices, we are truthful with ourselves. It's when we start lying to ourselves and when we start pointing the finger at somebody else. Well, I wouldn't have done it if they hadn't made me. If they hadn't done this, thus, this, and this, that, you know. That doesn't get anybody anywhere. Own up. Nobody on this planet is perfect. It's not going to ever happen. We're just not perfect. We make mistakes. Sometimes sometimes we wonder what in the world caused us to do that. But anyway, the kind thing to yourself is to own up to your mistakes, your misfortunes, when you miss the mark, when you just don't quite hit the bullseye with what you should have done. For instance, in my own life, I could look back and feel bad about myself for defining myself by my roles in my life instead of who I was. But it's all been a journey. It's got a good end, and it's not ended yet. You know, it's got a good outcome. I guess that's a better word. So that's what I want to say. Own up to it. Be honest with yourself, because in the long run, that just helps you.
Absolutely.
It just helps you.
Yeah. You can also find out more information about Patty at pattyfivette.com. That's PaddyFivette.com. You can find out about all of the different works that she has produced, the books and so forth, other information, and get in touch with her through that email or that website address. Patty Favette will be linked to you as well, Patty. And before we wrap up the program, let me ask you, who is Patty Favette?
I just am.
Okay.
I'm just me. I tend to look for the mystical side of life. I like to look beyond the normal. I feel like love is an inside job. I feel like a lot of people just are searching for love through another person, through another person, through another person, and relationships and this type of thing. When you can look in the mirror and feel your own love, and I'm not talking about narcissistic love. I'm talking about real divine spiritual love. Mm-hmm. When you can look in the mirror and know that right or wrong, good or bad choices, that you are okay just the way you are made, then you become yourself, and that when you are know yourself from the inside out as a state of being, as a state of I am, it's just when you finally get in contact with that inside person that is you, that inside spirit that is you, that inside soul that is you, then the things in your life that you do become an expression of who you are and what you are. Instead of trying to define yourself by what you do.
What is it that you hope to or want to achieve through the work that you are doing now?
I want people to know that they are love. I want people to know that they are loved. I want people to know that there is a higher power available to them. If you can call it what you want to, God, Holy Spirit, Spirit, you can get through it from religion. If that's what works for you, you can get through it from nature, however it works for you, but just make sure it's working for you and it's not harmful to someone else. And that is what I want to leave with people. I want people to know that they are divinely connected, that they are all intuitive, that they have, everybody has a gift that they can use, some sort of innate gift that allows them to understand spirit's loving message for their life, that they can be guided, and just they are wondrous as they are.
And who inspires you?
Who inspires me?
Mm-hmm.
Are you after a person? I would have to say it's beyond people, although I find a lot of people inspiring. For me, I get inspired when I walk through nature. I get inspired when I'm in the garden. I get inspired when I am in that still silent place of meditation that is not silent really at all, in the when you can get in that still point. When I get in that still point of meditation, it's like all creativity, all possibilities, all that is can be possible. That's what's inspiring to me. It's stillness. It's that still connection.
Patty Favette, I want to thank you so much for taking so much time to share with us today about you and your work and When Life Cried Out, One Woman's Spiritual Quest to Be Fully Alive. Again, thank you so much. This has been a great, great hour.
Thank you for asking me. I have thoroughly enjoyed this. It's like having a conversation with a friend.
Well, thank you.
That I've known forever. And I love it.
I consider you a friend as well.
You're quite good at what you do. I appreciate that.
Thank you so much. I want to let you also know, folks, that if you missed any part of this interview, there is an after view for the entire interview following the radio broadcast. There's more. There is always more. And we encourage you to go to the website, richarddugan.com, the radio show's page, and you can click on the link to the audio, as well as go to pattyfivette.com. That's PaddyFivette.com. Until our next program, I encourage you to check out our guest and their websites and the materials and get in touch with them. Say hello and see what resonates with you. Until next time, love Talal.